Get the knives out. Dish is about to be served. Outrageous. Are you kidding? I've been inside only one woman after I was born. The Statue of Liberty. Provocative. If it's a pain in the ass, honey, you're not doing it right. Pop culture. Meanwhile, she's on the cover of Us Weekly. Dating. Boyfriends are like jobs, except he probably stopped sucking after a year. Wicked. What do I look for in a guy? My dick. Smart. Sexy. Contemporary. I mean, I can't. Porn Again, the podcast. Hey everyone, it's Josh Sabara. Welcome to a new episode of Porn Again, the podcast. Tonight, I am thrilled to have with me my friend and special guest, Mr. Johnny Hazard, who is a titan of the gay porn industry. Hey, Johnny.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. I like that titan word.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think it applies. I give credit where credit is due. So I always start the podcast with a couple of things going on in the news that are annoying to me or that somehow just, you know, it's my version of Hot Topics. It's just they're annoying things. So are you familiar with the whole Erin Andrews issue that's going on with Marriott Hotels?
Now, the only stuff that I could really see was through TMZ, so I assume there was a little bias, but is...
No, not from TMZ.
No, right. Was someone spying on her through a peephole or something?
Yes, so she was staying at a Marriott. I want to say it was in Tennessee.
And it was.
The Marriott booked... She had a stalker, and the... And you know, look, as I don't know if you've ever had a stalker, very possibly being in your line of work, but I mean, that's no laughing matter. I understand that that's like a harrowing experience, but apparently they gave the stalker a room that was right next to hers, and he was able to set up, you know, a whole, you know, video camera system and basically videotape her changing and getting undressed through the peephole to the room. And then in addition to that, yes. So her concern was not only that that happened and that the Marriott Hotel, which I believe was individually owned. I don't know if they're all owned by like the same corporation. I think that some of them are owned separately, but not only was that hotel at fault, but was the guy at fault, but the hotel for creating a situation wherein that could happen. And so she sued, I believe, originally for something like $75 million because of personal suffering. And what they found out later was that one of the executives from the Marriott had the video on his phone and was out to dinner, and he was showing friends and colleagues the video that the stalker had taken and then commenting on her body and making fun of her. And a waitress at the restaurant overheard the conversation and actually called and reported it, which then added insult to injury because...
Holy shit, you can't make this stuff up.
Right. So I understand that she was upset and that obviously it's an invasion of privacy, and I'm not trying to diminish her suffering. But let's talk about the fact that she was awarded $55 million, okay? So she won the lawsuit.
It's a little much.
Right. Now, the guy who was the stalker is responsible for allegedly 28 million of that. Okay. Now, we know she's never going to get that from him because you're not going to get blood from a stone. Right. And apparently Marriott is, or the whoever owned the hotel is responsible for $27 million of that. Now, I'm sure that it's going to be appealed and that number is going to come down. And once you pay lawyers and, you know, because it's not a case in which there was a personal physical injury, she would have to pay taxes on her award. So, like, by the time you boil this all down, who knows what she's really going to walk away with? But the public's perception is that she was awarded $55 million. Now, I'm not trying to take away from her to say that, you know, and she was crying on the witness stand and saying, you know, that she'll never be able to forget this. And, you know, every day she's going to think about it. Now, I am not saying that it's right and it is a horrible, horrible thing that happened to her. But $55 million? I mean, what does that say to all of these people who, what about somebody who is raped? I mean, the many people who are, who go through all kinds of... who go through, you know, all of these horrible things. And, you know, they don't, they're lucky if they even see the perpetrator put behind bars.
Right.
So, like, I mean, how do you put a price on the suffering and what happened to her? And is that outrageous, $55 million?
It's slightly outrageous. I think it's just kind of allowing people to just be really kind of careless with who they sue and the amount of money that people can just think that they can get away with.
Well, and if the idea was to send a message, then, you know, now again, I can't speak for Erin Andrews. I don't know what she's doing with the money. She may very well be, you know, doing something great with it and we don't know. But then I'd like to see her publicly, you know, announce that she's going to do something with that money to help women or to empower women or, you know, put that money to good, because we know that the $55 million isn't going to make her less embarrassed about what happened, is it? No. It's not going to make the situation go away. I mean, what does it really make better?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is sort of how I look
at
it. And then in related news, I imagine you've heard about the Hulk Hogan situation.
Oh, my God.
I mean, what do you think about that? So that was $115 million.
That just screams and reeks of a publicity stunt.
That doesn't it?
That's what it spells out to me. I mean, sex tape, hello. And then the fact that, you know, he's probably not making a lot of money. And, you know, when you're in need of cash, you make a sex tape. And I think it went wrong. And I think he sued, and I think he made out like a bandit, and that's just bullshit.
I mean, and again, you know Gawker is going to appeal. I mean, you know that, you know, just because you hear these numbers like $115 million, it doesn't mean somebody's writing him a check tomorrow. But it's...
Well, there was a witness that they weren't able to call that they're hopefully going to get on the appeal, which seems to be, you know, the missing link to their defense.
So, I mean, I'm very curious to see what that piece of evidence is.
Totally.
That could really,
totally.
That, you know, if that could turn this around. But, I mean, to me, the way I mean, I hear something like this and I just think, I didn't even know Hulk Hogan was still with us. So, to me, it's just I think it was a positive thing. I mean, I forget that he can get it up. I didn't even know that he was still alive.
Right.
You know, I mean, call me crazy, but...
So
there
it
you
really
go.
Worked in his favor.
There you go.
Everyone thought he was dead.
So, speaking of sex tapes, that is something that is...
I have a sex tape.
You have a number of sex tapes. Although, is it really fair to call them tapes? Like, were you working at a time when things were still on VHS, or was it DVD?
It's funny you say that. Yeah, no, I can never honestly say that I have a sex tape.
You don't, unless somebody actually transferred your DVD to a tape, which I don't think people go in that direction.
I don't think that that's possible.
But don't you think that it's so much easier? I mean, having a DVD is so much easier because you know, and obviously the internet has made this even easier because you can just go to specific moments in a scene. But, I mean, remember when things were on VHS tape and you literally had to rewind or fast forward to the point that actually could get you off?
I just remember having lugged them all around. Boxes.
I mean, it was like a god. The DVD was a godsend to the porn industry.
Yeah, it was also the beginning of the end.
So let's talk about that. So I'm curious, just in terms of your background, what age did you realize you were gay? Are you somebody who sort of knew early on?
In
or
the womb.
Were you,
In the womb.
Really? I was the same way, which is funny because my father, who, you know, my father's a urologist, so he's like a very scientific, clinical thinker. And he says to me, he always says to me, I can't understand how you knew that you were gay. He's like, I wasn't even sexualized at that point. I didn't know that I liked women or girls at that point. And I can't explain it other than to say that there's this sort of fiber of awareness that just runs through you, and you know that there's something different about yourself inside.
Right.
I mean, did you have that same thing?
Yep. I just couldn't really put a finger on it until, you know, the day that I realized I was gay was the day that my cousin made this horrible, horrible joke about how do you seat four gay men? And then he turned the stool that was next to him upside down. Mm. And I was like, oh, so that's how this all worked. Well,
how old were you when that happened?
I think it was around 10, 9, 10, somewhere around there. And it just kind of was the missing link that I just needed to kind of, you know, spell out D-A-Y.
Right.
Took a stool.
Right.
Upside down. Kind of fill in all the pieces.
And did you ever experiment? Like, had you, as a kid, did you ever do that doctor thing or any of those kinds of, like exploring other kids?
Yeah, it was a girl. It was in day camp during the summer, and she told on me, and I got in trouble. And that was it for the girl. I did have sex with one when I was 12. That was, like, really end of girls. And then in between there was always, you know, loose experimentation with the neighborhood boys.
But when you say sex with a girl, actual intercourse or just fooling around?
No, like actual penetration. I think it lasted all of 20 seconds.
Wow. And then have you had sex with a woman as an adult?
No.
Got it. You realized that was enough. You would?
Yeah, as I've gotten older, I think I am more comfortable with the female race, and I might be tempted to do it. I'd be more inclined to do it if her boyfriend was there and he was, like, super hot.
So, but you consider yourself gay and not bisexual?
Now we're kind of treading into different waters here. I mean, if you really kind of define it, I can't really say I'm bisexual because I haven't really kind of confirmed it.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say no.
So do you see, like, will you see a woman on the street and say, wow, she's attractive, like, I could see myself, like, I would want to have sex with her? Because that's never happened to me. I can know that somebody's sexy, but, you know, on the spectrum, if one is not gay and 10 is gay, I'm an 11. So, like, I have no need to ever experiment.
I watched straight porn. So in the last, like, handful of years, I have looked at the female body, you know, in a completely different light. So I cannot honestly say that I am 100% gay at this moment in time.
Now, you said you watch straight porn. Has that been, have you always done that, or that's a more recent thing?
That's a more recent thing. I have never been a fan of straight porn, but just like I said, in the last handful of years, it's become the only thing that I watch primarily.
Got it. So your first sexual experience then was with a girl. So the 12 was the first one, or the camp thing at 9.
If we talk about, like, penetrating,
no, just like sexual experience. Period.
Oh. Yeah, I think it was in day camp when she let me look down her shirt.
Got it. And so what kind of straight porn is it that interests you? Is there a specific brand or a particular, you know, genre of porn that is most interesting to you when there's a woman involved?
I tend to like the gangbangs, like a lot of guys on one girl. There's just, like, this subtle element of homoeroticism that I find really attractive.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that could have something to do with just that there are so many men and you like the extra
penises? That's what I can't say definitively.
Right.
But, you know, that being said, I could be one of those men.
Right.
And, you know, enjoy it.
Now, you did a couple of, or was it one? I know there was at least one porn movie that was a gangbang that you were involved in.
On a girl?
No, all men.
Oh.
That you were in the movie.
Yeah, I'm sure there are countless.
Oh, there were, okay, I only knew of one.
Yeah.
But, okay, so are those actually shot that way, where they're shot as a continuous gangbang, or is... And not to ruin the illusion for anybody, but, or, you know, do you sort of break in between them and then edit it together?
Both. I've been on sets where they kind of wanted to get it all done. So we had multiple cameras going.
Right.
And I've also been on set where it was a cut and paste kind of job.
Got it. And do you, which for you as a performer is... easier? Like, do you prefer to just kind of have the breaks and let them edit it, or do you get into it and just sort of want to go with it?
I just want to get it over with. So my preference has always been, let's just do it. You know, no breaks, just everyone suck it up, suck it in, put it out, and let's go.
And has there ever been a time where you have been interested in the person that you're partnered with, or that you are actually excited to have sex with that person, or is it always a job to you?
I think I can probably use two hands to count the times where I actually enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Any sort of romantic interest beyond the set may have been there prior to the scene, but either during the scene or after the scene, that fantasy was quickly shattered, was squashed,
right? So I imagine that you've worked with men who identify as straight, or who they call gay for pay.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear your does that mean that you don't think that they're really gay, or that they're just on the fence about it, or that it's not a pleasurable experience?
Actually, all of the above. I can remember scenarios for each, you know, guys that just kind of played on that. You know, I'm a straight guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of their brand. I was with guys that really just didn't want to be there and kind of made everyone very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I tended to like those guys because, one, there was not going to be any emotional involvement. They were there to do a job,
right?
Number one. Number two, they wanted to get it done. They didn't want to talk. They didn't want to play around. They wanted to get in and get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that, especially when it got to the point in my career where it was a job and there was nothing enjoyable about it, and you were just there for a paycheck. So you just kind of wanted to do your job and get it over with. You don't want to date, and you don't want to talk, and you don't want to break the pineapple.
Right. So at the beginning, when you first started out doing porn, was there that excitement to you? Like, was there that sort of like, oh, this is going to be fun because I'm going to get to have...
Oh, yeah.
And how long did it take for that to wear off?
Probably... around 2008, 2009, when the whole business model began to shift.
Mm-hmm. And how did it shift?
It literally happened. I recall it just being overnight. I remember we were in Florida,
mm-hmm.
and she called me up to her room, and she said,
This is
the
Gigi
last
LaRue, who owns,
on salary.
Who owns Channel 1.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the infamous Gigi LaRue, Channel
right.
1, Wrathful Video, you know, the woman who discovered me.
Right.
As you would say.
Okay.
And then they saw the whole shift coming. You know, they are very smart business people. So they knew it was coming, and they gave me a heads up. And that was the beginning of the end. It was with that conversation.
That you would no longer be under contract for them.
Because they're not going to make as much money as they had before.
Got it. So then your income decreases, and then what happens? You wind up looking for porn work with other companies to make up the difference?
Yeah, but that wasn't the plan. You know, I had bought a condo in Palm restaurant in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And my plan was to sell it like everyone else was.
Right.
And, you know, that was going to be my out of the porn world.
Right.
But 2008 happened. And in that same year is when I had that conversation with Shishi. So it was a double whammy.
Right.
So I had to look for work elsewhere. I had to kind of give up my salary. I had to be this contractual, you know, employee on a, you know, day-by-day basis. And it sucked. And it just that was a really, really bad year on a lot of levels financially.
Well, and you're out of that, thankfully. So in your personal dating life, how soon do you tell people that you were involved in porn? Like, how soon into a relationship would you mention that to someone? Because obviously, I assume if you don't get it out of the way, people think you're hiding something.
Or, in the last 5 years, people already know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have to do that any longer. But in the beginning, I said it immediately because it was, you just kind of wanted to cut them off at the pass. You don't want someone else filling their head with their opinions of you. You
right.
want to be able to kind of get to it first.
And how do people usually react? Like, more times than not, did you get a, you know, I don't care response? Or has anyone ever walked away over that because they couldn't handle it?
Yeah, there were, I think times. It was like around 2010 or 11, and I remember a handful of guys just didn't work out because of the porn thing, and that could have, you know, been for a myriad of reasons, but, you know, it all boiled down to the fact that I did porn. Nowadays, everyone's done porn. No one cares.
Well, and what do you think about
that?
What do you think about the fact that everybody with a camera and a Wi-Fi connection thinks he's a porn star?
Well, the word porn star has been bastardized. I mean,
right.
I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I was last.
No, but you were really like deal. Right. You were like the real deal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Now it's evolution. It's just kind of what has happened with everything. And unfortunately, you know, I rode that last wave, but, you know, I wasn't able to kind of really take it any farther because, you know, everything changed.
So continuing about dating, like do you use dating or hookup apps at all now?
I laugh because I do from time to time, not so much anymore.
Right.
But for a long time, I didn't understand why no one would respond to me.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Really good-looking guys, didn't respond to me because they didn't believe it was me.
Right. They thought that you basically stole Johnny Hazard's picture.
Exactly. And it took me about a year and a half, 2 years to finally realize that.
Like, why do all these men want to?
Such a relief.
Why do all these men want to buy my videos, but yet, when I'm looking to have a real relationship, they won't even speak to me.
It was really depressing. It really did. It hurt.
Now, what does being in porn and being sort of idolized and having people look at you and see, you know, what, you know, you're obviously in great shape and you take care of yourself and what does that do for your self-esteem? And were you somebody who grew up feeling good about yourself and your body and were just able to have that confidence that people are attracted to, or did you grow into that? And are you comfortable with people seeing you that way?
I grew into it. I was not happy with myself. And I think that's probably one of the main reasons, if not the reason, why I got into porn was, you know, just to kind of heal that little boy that never felt like he was attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Am I comfortable with myself now? I mean, not entirely. I don't think anyone really is. But ironically, I'm totally fine with, like, for instance, my English class, which is a bunch of children. I could be their father, knows about me. And so I know that they've gone onto the internet and looked, and I look around the room and I tell myself, all these people have seen you naked, and honestly, it does not bother me. I would take my clothes off in front of them tomorrow if I had to.
Yeah, but you seem, I mean, you
it's
and I,
ironic.
You and I actually did a promo shoot for my book, and you were so comfortable. I mean, you walked in and, you know, I had known you, so I wasn't uncomfortable, but the photographer, you know, even she, I think, you know, was surprised when you first, because even though the photos are suggestive, you're not nude in that, you're not, you don't see anything, but in order to get the shots, you had to not have clothes on, and you just seemed so right. comfortable, like you just walked in the room, and, you know, in a million years, nobody would have thought that you were somebody who was body conscious, because, I mean, if I looked right. like you, I'd go to Gelson's naked, you know? it's funny that you're, that there's sort of that piece of you that can just go into that mode yeah. and do it.
It's called detachment disorder. And it's one of the reasons why I was so good at doing porn.
Because you could take yourself out. You weren't attached to the situation at all or the people.
Exactly.
Involved. Got it. So back to actually doing the porn. Actually, let's stay on dating for a second. So when you meet these people or meet guys that you want to go home with or who could be a romantic possibility, is there, because of your background as a porn star, is there an expectation of how you're going to be in bed? And is that something that, you know, gives you some trepidation? Like, are you concerned about what the expectations might be?
No, it's the other way around for the most part. Guys are self-conscious about their level of performance. And I have to remind them when it does come out, you know, you've already won. You know, you don't have to worry about anything, number one. Number two, what you see on the screen is a product of editing. And it's not anything what you see. That scene exists in your head.
Right.
I can tell you something. It did not play out that way.
Right. So is there anything when you were working in the business, is there anything that you were uncomfortable doing sexually on camera that you had to sort of put your foot down and say, you know, this isn't my thing. I'm not going to do this. Or things that you were asked to do that just you could not get your head around?
Yeah. I was never the bottom for a pissing scene.
Okay.
And I never was the bottom in a gangbang.
Okay.
And I never did bareback. So I think those three things were, you know, my boundaries.
And is there anything you've done on camera that you were so turned off by that you wouldn't be interested in doing it in your real life?
On camera, no.
Okay. So you're pretty open-minded sexually.
Yeah. I mean, I'll try anything once. I still don't like to be pissed on.
I always say to people, I'll try anything 50 times. Okay, so and it's funny that you mentioned the piss play, because that's actually something we're going to get to a little later because of a question that somebody wrote in from my sex column. So that's perfect for us to discuss. So do you consider yourself in terms of sexually, do you consider yourself versatile as a gay man? And how do you deal with men?
Like when men are,
right. Because when men are interested in a relationship, sometimes you meet these people and they're so resolute in their position. Like, you know, I am a top only, or I am a whatever only, and they're so inflexible. And I think relationships are all about compromise. And that is in terms of everything, not just who takes out the garbage, but compromise in what you have to do to please each other sexually. And I think people limit themselves or they miss out on possibly great partners because they're not willing to sort of be more open-minded or try new things.
There is a guy that I dated here in Cleveland for about 2 months. And probably the biggest reason why we didn't work out is because, one, and this is a minor thing, but in the big picture, it kind of added up. He wouldn't eat ass because of a bad experience he had, which I get. But the second thing is that he wouldn't let me fuck him. And when he did the one time, you know, I had to hear about it for 2 days, how much pain he was in. And even while I was doing it, I could totally tell that he was, you know, grimacing and just praying for the moment it was over. And I just can't get with that, you know?
Well, I mean, and how is that supposed to be fulfilling to you? To sit there and think, I mean,
right.
you're supposed to be, I mean, part of the turn on of sex is feeling like you're giving the other person pleasure. And
right.
here you are with somebody who, you know, is sort of gnashing his teeth through it.
Right.
You know, so the,
you can't get past it.
So the rimming is important to you.
If I were able to fuck him, it wouldn't have been a big issue, but okay. because there was already that foundation of nose, it was just
right.
like one more thing.
Right. Right. So,
it's not a deal breaker.
I don't know. I think anybody who, I mean, unless it's something extreme, I don't, you know, I don't like a list of, and I was even this way in my professional life. Like, I don't list like a list of things that people don't or can't do. You know, I mean, it's like, I get it if there's something that's, you know, a little what we might consider out of the ordinary or over the top, that there are certain things that might push people or, you know, be a non-starter. But for the most part, you know, I say if it's legal and consensual, like, come on. You know, I think people need to, there needs to be sort of a give and take there.
I'm with you 100%.
So why did you, I mean, when, why did you ultimately decide to retire from porn in general? I know you're in school right now, learning sign language, which I think is amazing. So what was it that sort of was the impetus to leave the industry?
That conversation and the fact that I was never going to get ahead in the business. I was never going to make the amount of money that I used to make. And the longer I stayed and tried to hold on to it, the more I was going to kind of crash and burn, if that makes sense. It was better to go out on top, every pun intended.
Right.
And just, you know, call it a day. But I'll tell you what, if I could still make the money today as I did, you know, 6 years ago, I would still be doing it, for sure.
And do you have any, what the permanence of porn, you know, it's now everything's a permanent record. So every scene you've done, every video that you've done is online, everything's all over the place. Do you have any issue with that at all, or you're completely comfortable with that at this point?
Point, dude. Yeah, I mean, I've gotten used to it, but the gravity of what that meant didn't really sink in for like the first 3 years, 3 or 4 years.
And if it had, do you think that you would have made a choice to earn your living in a different way, or do you think you still, sort of knowing who you are now, do you think you would have gone ahead and gone into the business?
I think I may have thought about it a little bit longer, but at the end of the day, I still would have done it.
Got it. And was part of the appeal going into it was the experimentation and the getting the variety of partners and that kind of thing? Or was it the idea that people would look at you a certain way and that you would sort of be this sort of sought after, adored person? Or is it somehow a mix of the both?
The latter to a lesser degree, but the biggest reason was I was 24 years old, and I was flying all over the country and all over Europe, and I was making a shitload of money.
Mm-hmm. Now, did your...
That was the main reason.
I know I've seen, you know, pictures of your lovely mother, and she, you know, will be... I've seen her holding
Mom.
Up a copy of a magazine that you're on the cover of or something. So obviously, she's aware of the career choice that you made and is completely comfortable with it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, initially, you know, she had her concerns, and they were all very, very valid concerns. You know, she grew up in a generation, especially her and the person she is, where she thought of porn studios to be these basement, you know, back rooms that were drug-fueled, you know, in red lights with, you know, seedy people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? A lot of that is true. But it wasn't true in my case. So for her, what I wanted to do and what I did do is I had her come out to the studios to L.A. and meet Shishi and come to the studio and see these and see how it is, you know, humanize it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not this backroom, dirty, seedy thing. It's a legit business with really good people that have treated me exceptionally well and that I've done quite well at.
Mm-hmm. And how does she feel like
that was important?
But the fact that you sort of reached this level of stardom in the industry, that you sort of were like at the top of it, and the, you know, one of the most interesting performers and one of the most sought after performers, how did she feel about that? I mean, there has to be, I mean, it's a weird thing because there has to be some kind of pride in that, that that's, you know, your kid who everybody is drooling over. But at the same time, there's, you know, this sort of aspect of it that's not comfortable for some people.
Right. My mother is a very hip lady, and she will be the first to tell anyone my son is a gay porn star.
So does she have any of the awards that you've won? Are they, where do those sit? Are they in her house or what?
The awards, yeah, the awards are in my closet. They just kind of sit in the back. But she has a cardboard box that she has been known to bring out on certain alcohol-fueled events with all of my magazines. With all of my covers, some of my best interviews, you know, select photos that she likes, you know, that she, it's my porn scrapbook.
Got it.
Essentially.
Now, in terms of these interviews that you had done, when you would talk to the gay press and the porn press, how much of the person behind Johnny Hazard do you give away, and how much of it do you really keep for yourself? I mean, how much of it is, you know, the answers that people want to read versus who you really are?
Well, pretty much all of those interviews were all just for, you know, porno mags, or they were for porno sites, so they were all kind of peppered with the same sort of questions. It wasn't until later, you know, when Tiger Orange came out and I started to kind of make this transition, that the questions became a little more in-depth. But in the beginning, it was, you know, just make it as salacious and juicy as possible.
And how does it
like
feel?
The questions you're asking were brassed. I mean, these are, you know, nice, well-thought-out, in-depth questions.
Thank you. Well, that's sort of the point of this, is like, I just wanted to demystify it a little bit because, you know, especially knowing you, I know there's a smart person, you know, a good person under the picture on that DVD sleeve, you know, and right. Most people don't get the benefit of finding that out. And so what I'm wondering is when you see that video sleeve and you see yourself in these pictures, how easy is it for you to separate yourself from that person? Like, do you look at that and see a completely different person? Or, like, now that you've sort of transitioned to some degree, do you, have they sort of swirled together? And how do you separate
them? I guess they've kind of swirled together. They were always one and the same, because I treated both of them just so kind of interchangeably.
Mm-hmm. But is it like liberating? Is it like freeing to be yourself now? That there's no artifice about it. It's like you are you now. You're not what people. Excuse me. You're not what you don't have to be. What people expect you to be or want you to be. You can really be yourself. Like, it's not an alter ego anymore.
Never really was an alter ego, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of things that, you know, I would do in a movie that I wouldn't do in my personal life. You know, in that regard, it was a persona. But for the most part, it was all just kind of me. You know, the alter ego is usually a product of someone else's imagination.
Got it. So what happens when, how often do you get recognized? And when people do recognize you, what do they expect from you? And how, you know, how do you deliver for them, or do you not feel that responsibility anymore to do that?
That was such a great statement at the end of that. I was in Palm Springs a couple of weeks ago, and I was in Sally Beauty Supply looking for a petty egg, you know, those things that you do your
as one does. But I like to call them pedophiles.
Pedophile, that was good. Bada bing, bada bing.
I'm here all week.
And the guy's like, I recognize you. And I was like, oh, here we go. And he goes, you wrote that article for the Huffington Post. And I had to bring myself back and not put on the Johnny response, but kind of put on the other more appreciative, kind of genuinely, you know, happy that I was recognized for something other than the porn stuff. But to speak on when I got recognized as Johnny Hazard, there was always this tinge of kind of, for lack of a better word, just kind of like predatorial. It was gross. You know, you kind of see it in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they would say, oh, you're Johnny Hazard. Oh, I see you. And it made you just want to, like, put on some clothes, even though you had clothes on.
That's interesting. One of my former guests was a straight female porn star, Missy Martinez. And she sort of we talked about the idea that when she meets people, particularly at porn conventions or at things where that's what you're there for, that people feel like they have the right to touch you or have the right to behave with you in a certain way because of what it is that you do on camera. Did you find a problem with that?
Absolutely. There was actually a year where I had in my contract that I would not have to go to the convention in Vegas. Because it felt like you were at a petting zoo, but you weren't being petted, you were being molested. And that was just a very concentrated form of the general idea, because people see you on a screen in their, you know, private setting, and there are no boundaries. You're getting fucked, you're getting this, you're getting that. So they kind of get into real life, and there's still, you know, the complete dissolve of boundaries. So they feel like because they touch themselves to you in their living room, that it's okay for them to touch you in the Gelson's. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So how do you deal with that? Like, how do you deal with that and not lose a fan? Like to be somewhat gracious, but yet have to set a boundary at the same time? Or do you just forget about that and punch them?
Yeah. When you're in Vegas, you are actually required to do that. And of course, there's a limit to how much they can touch you. So that's different, but in real life, you know, if they couldn't respect the boundary, then I really didn't have time for it. I was never an asshole off the bat. If pushed, I would be.
Mm-hmm.
I was always humble and gracious, and I just, you know, cut it off at the pass and try and remove myself from the situation. But after a while, you can smell it. You can smell where it was going. You can just tell by the look in their eye or the tone of their voice where it was going to go. So you just kind of had a jump on it.
Got it. So tell me a little bit about Tiger Orange, which is a movie that you headline. Did the film festival circuits and was extremely well received, and your performance was well received. Tell me what that feeling's like to all of a sudden see your real name on a different kind of video and see your face on the big screen. I mean, what's that like after having had the experiences you did with porn and then sort of walking into this entirely other other world?
It was very validating.
I mean, you had done some acting before. I mean, I'm sure people know that you had done some shows for Hear Media. Is that right? Some TV.
Yeah, but it was a very minor role. I did 2 seasons. I was one of, like, you know, 20 characters. It was nothing, you know, on the level of Tiger Orange. You know, there was no film festivals. There was no, you know, posters of me on a bus stop in Bologna, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real nice taste of being appreciated for something that I actually did. People would always say for my porn, oh, I love your work, or, you know, what you do is so good. Well, not really. You know, I get an erection, I keep it up, I fuck someone, and then I call it a day.
Right.
You know, I never could really let that in. But with Tiger Orange, it's like, yeah, you know what? I thank you. You know, I did do that. And that was because I was a good actor. And that was because of my skills. So, yes, Thank you for saying that.
So with that kind of a claim that comes with that, did the bug not get you, or do you think you'll go back and do something else? Because it seems a shame that you sort of have that natural talent, and you know,
you are the first person to ask me that since everything kind of changed. You know, you being in the middle of Hollywood can probably really, really understand this. You know, it's nothing is guaranteed,
right.
And I am, you know, 38 years old, and I thought about it, and it's like, all right, well, yeah, I have this movie now, and yeah, I may have something above most other people, but I'm still one of thousands of people in this city trying to do the same thing, and no one is knocking on my door saying, here's a part, we'll pay you $40,000. No one was saying that, so what I, you know, pictured myself doing was going back to L.A., and doing the same thing that I've been doing for years, which is wait around for the phone to ring for something that may or may not happen. And in the meantime, what am I doing to support myself? I'm waiting tables, I'm tending bar, and probably, you know, calling companies to see if I could, you know, do a porno scene. And I just decided that that was not going to make me happy. So that's when I decided to go back to school. But to answer your question, yes, I do want to go back to it. I just want to have a better way to support myself than I had before.
So do you see yourself coming back? You're in Ohio right now. Do you see yourself coming back to L.A. and sort of aligning yourself with, you know, an agent or a manager and supporting yourself
Absolutely.
With the sign language? Or do you want to just kind of do it from a distance or attempt to do it from a distance?
I think I'd probably want to come back to L.A. and immerse myself in it and give it a really good college try.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I honestly do think I have a shot, but it's just, in, you know, like I said, what am I going to do in the meantime? Because nothing is guaranteed.
Right. No, I think it's smart. I think it's smart to have, you know, to be learning this skill, which, by the way, will be helpful to so many people. So at least it's something that you can be doing that can earn money and that feels good to be doing, you know, while you're waiting to see what happens. But, you know, I feel like since you had this experience and it was good and people were receptive to it, I feel like it's sort of a shame to not pursue it in some way.
Yeah, I wrestled with that for a really long time. Do I go back or do I just, you know, put it on the back burner? And, I obviously came to the conclusion of not quite yet.
So are you dating anyone now, or are you single?
Oh, no. Since I couldn't fuck that one guy, that was it. He was the only available guy in Cleveland, so.
The only one. Well, I would imagine that it is. I mean, I love when people say things to me like, you know, it's really hard dating in L.A., or it's really hard. And like, you talk to anybody in any city and they'll tell you it's really hard dating there. It's not about the location that you're in. It's just hard to date, period. You know, like
anywhere.
People say, oh, I'm
New
not
York,
inspired.
LA, they, Cleveland.
People say, I'm not inspired in L.A. I'm like, no, you're just not inspired. You don't even have to put the L.A. part there. And I think it's so interesting that people like who have such dating misfortune blame it on the place that they live.
The grass is always greener.
So there's not a big well to draw from. Is that it?
No, because once the gay boys realize where they're at and they're old enough to leave Cleveland, they do.
That makes sense. Now, have you ever dated a fan?
I did once, and that went really well, and it was all my fault. I ruined it. I was a very bad boyfriend. He was and is a very great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize to him.
And when you say you were a bad boyfriend, what does that mean?
It means that I had really issues with intimacy,
mm-hmm.
and instead of just being open and upfront, I kind of led him on and made him me before I had to break up with him.
So, is there a possibility to do? Like, can there be a do-over? I mean, now that you've sort of had this sense of self-awareness and, you know, I don't know where he is in his life, but is it possible to revisit?
No, because we've both kind of turned into these people now, and it's not that he's a bad person in any way. It's just we're really not compatible.
Got it. Well, that happens. So is there, so if people want to follow you on Twitter, it's at Johnny Hazard. And if they want to follow you on Instagram, it's at Johnny Hazard 1. Is that right?
Yeah, because I thought someone took Johnny Hazard, but it may have been me and I just forgot my password because there's been no posts.
All right. So Johnny Hazard 1 on Instagram and Johnny Hazard on Twitter. And then also you make some great clothes and accessories, which you've actually made for me, some bags and some shirts.
You're like one of my best clients.
I love your stuff. In fact, if you remember, I like wore it to, I did something with Katy Perry and I was like wearing it and you're like, oh, give one to Katy. I love them. They're great. But I mean, I know that there's limited stock based on the time that you have, but people can visit Spitshine LA, which is the website to look at that.
And see what's there, see what's happening. It's always changing depending on availability, cash flow, time.
Yep. So, and now just, we have 3 more minutes. So I just want to, I know I told you I was going to get into the piss play and the golden showers, and I'm not going to go back on my word. So one of the questions that I got for an upcoming Gay Times column was somebody named Christopher in London, and he wrote to me about his current boyfriend likes the idea of piss play, but he questions the health factor, and he also doesn't understand why it's such a turn on. Now, when I talk to people anecdotally and I bring it up, the first thing people say is, I don't get it. Like, I just don't get what people get out of it, and it's not a turn-on, and I don't understand why. And yet, it continues to appear in porn films and erotic fiction. So people, it's not in those creative places because people don't want to see it or read about it. So what is it? Is it a role play thing, a dominant versus submissive thing? Because when you mentioned it to me, you said you won't be a piss play bottom. So I assume that means you won't be the person being urinated on.
Correct.
So what do you, from what you've gathered professionally or in your personal life, what do you think it is about that sort of is a turn on to people?
I think it's twofold. Primarily what I've seen and what I think is that it's a role play. It's a humiliation thing. It is rooted in something else that goes, you know, deeper than the surface. Mm-hmm. And then two, on a purely physical kind of aesthetic level, it's warm and it's wet. There you go.
Right. Well, you know, what I say to people is, and there really isn't, in terms of health factor, there really isn't it's a very low-risk behavior. I mean, urine, for the most part, is sterile. It's made of, you know...
Right, you're not going to catch the clap from getting peed on.
Now, there are, you know, if you have certain diseases or bacteria, it can show up in urine, but for the most part, urine is an inhospitable host. It doesn't really transmit anything.
Correct.
But one of the things that I thought was interesting, because somebody, you know, I've gotten a number of these questions, and they were talking about liking the idea of, rather than ejaculating inside somebody, urinating inside somebody. And
what
it's difficult because, number one, you're turned on, right? So it's like your brain is telling you that you want to come, and your head is telling you that you want to pee. So it's kind of like this confusing thing. But
it's exhausting.
But what's funny about it is that, you know, just like they use suppositories to get certain medications into people and, you know, people use all kinds of drugs that way because it's an easy route into the bloodstream. If the insertive partner has been using any illegal drugs, it can get into the blood. It can get into the bottom in that case. So I always warn people that's something to think about, especially if you're going to be taking a drug test. You know, you may not have taken it, but.
Good point.
There you go. So anyway, well, that sort of wraps up our hour. And again, I'll just repeat, you know, Spit Shine LA. If people want to look for some of the clothes you designed, at Johnny Hazard on Twitter and at Johnny Hazard One on Instagram. And I'm so grateful that you came on and were so honest with us. So thank you.
Anytime. You've always been one of my biggest supporters, and I will do anything for you.
Likewise. Thank you.
All right, Joshy. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. The No Holds Barred conversation continues 24/7 on Facebook at Josh Sabara Author and Twitter and Instagram at Josh Sabara. And then buckle your seatbelts for some titillating real talk. Porn Again, a memoir by Josh Sabara, is available now as a trade paperback, ebook, and audiobook.